Among our many visitors this morning, there is one lady whom I have seen only once before in an airport, and her husband, whom I last saw floating down the Buffalo River in a canoe. They've been here a couple of times, but I haven't had a chance to say hello to them. I'm asking Toby and Laura to wait a moment this morning so I can speak. Toby doesn't look the same with a suit and a shave. I think it would be hard to find a more brutal judgment than the one you heard a few minutes ago when Andrew read the scripture. A man leaving on a trip calls three employees and gives each one an amount of money based on his ability to use it. One gets $5,000, another $2,000, and another gets one. Some sentimental person standing by might have objected and said, "This is not fair. They should all have the same gift." But this is a story drawn from life, and life is not fair. You can find that out no matter what you do, but some jobs teach you quicker and better than others. I have done my work in the church and in the university, and I have learned some things sooner from the university than I could have learned them from the church. For example, a church tends to attract people who are quite a bit alike. But a university with an open admissions policy gets an incredible diversity, from the painfully handicapped to the winner of the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. So for a lifetime, the classroom has let me look deeply into the minds of students from every imaginable background. I meet the child who grew up surrounded by love and guidance and is standing on the threshold of maturity with all the crucial pride it takes to do well, blessed with a world of confidence, poise, and initiative, all those good things which are mostly, don't ever forget it, a gift from others. And I also meet the child who is poverty-stricken in all these things, by accident of birth or environment, abused mentally or physically, no knowledge of the world of books and travel and intellectual sensitivity. The differences are often so great that my only quarrel with the parable is that it might have used 5,000 at one end and 5 cents at the other to shock us into seeing how uneven the gifts of life can be. We're talking about parables this month. And if this one is to be taken seriously, the first thing we learn is that all men are not created equal. Since they aren't expected to achieve in exactly the same ways. But they are all expected to do the best they can. So the first man in our story studies the market, finds out what the crop prospects are, takes a look at the troop movements, and invests his $5,000 so well that he makes an astonishing 100% profit. The second man, not quite so clever, not quite so energetic, plods away at the job. If his money is invested in the farm, he works the oxen hard. If it's invested in a vineyard on the side of a Judean hill. He prunes and ties from dawn until darkness. By sheer hard work, he turns his $2,000 into $4,000. The third man, who is really the centerpiece of this story, because he is like so many of us, is not bad or wasteful. He doesn't squander his $1,000. In fact, perhaps because it is such a small gift and seems so vulnerable, he doesn't want to take any chances with it. So he slips out into the garden and buries it. That was the usual way of protecting money in a country that had no banks. Cautious, conservative, he expects to be praised for his prudence. But at that very moment, the story explodes into high praise and hot anger. The boss says to the first two, "You've been reliable and faithful, and I'm proud of you." But he says sarcastically to the guy who played it safe, "If nothing else, you could at least have lent the money out, and when I came back, I would have had the capital along with the interest." One message sits right on the surface of the parable. We are expected to do something with whatever gift of skill and energy we have. We can't sit back because we have less than someone else. We can't be afraid to risk losing and wounding our pride. We have to try. Now comes the part so hard to take. To the ones standing around watching, the boss says, "Take this man's $1,000 away from him. This gift he has put into the deep freeze, and give it to the man who already has $10,000. For the man who has will always get more. And the man who has not will forfeit even what he has." Now this tough, unsympathetic superintendent is not Christ. But in telling the story, Christ is clearly saying that this is the way the world operates. And somewhere in the story, there is a word about how the kingdom of God operates. Unfair as it may seem, life really does keep giving more and more to those who already have. And it consistently cheats those who have not. As one example, I present to you my already gifted student who picks up from every assignment twice as much as the rest. He reads a book, listens to a lecture, and what he brings from his own enriched past helps him interpret and grow in ways the poor student cannot even fathom. He's already ahead. He gets further and further ahead with each job well done. Take a person who is already rich in curiosity and send her off on a trip with a friend who has no curiosity at all. And see what happens to them. The woman already rich will come back with more knowledge and an even more intense curiosity, while the other will be bored, learn little, and come back home convinced that the world has nothing to teach. Worse off than when the trip began. She had little curiosity. She now has even less. We love to complain on the economic front that the rich get richer. And we are right. That too is a general law of life. But the intellectually rich get richer too. And the spiritually rich get richer. And nothing can change that any more than anyone can repeal the law of gravity. Read 10 books this year, and the 10 you read next year will enrich your expanded mind by twice as much. Show compassion to people in need this month, and next month we'll find your compassion deeper and more complex than ever. Refuse to show compassion, and what little pity you have in your heart dries up, and you are colder than ever. If I could convince people that even a small talent grows by use, there would be no parasites hunting a free and easy life, and there would be no freeloaders saying, let somebody else do it, somebody with more talent or more time than I have. But if the judgment is harsh on one hand, it is merciful on the other. Because the clear implication of this story is not how much did you make of your life, but how much did you make compared with what you were given. And any other view of justice would be unthinkable. I would be paralyzed if I had to measure myself by the Apostle Paul, or by Augustine, or by Albert Schweitzer. These were five talent people, like Shakespeare in drama, Michelangelo in art, Edison in the realm of invention. They were given much. They put it to work. That brought them even more, and they were accountable for a world of talent. But I also have a work to do, some talent to spend, and I can respect myself, even if my work is far less than theirs, so long as I do it as faithfully as I can. The master in the parable made absolutely no difference between the five-talent man and the two-talent man. Same praise, same welcome. Here is a moment from history that underscores what I mean. When David Livingstone, the great Scottish medical missionary, was buried in Westminster Abbey, many people looked curiously at the black man who stood at the head of the casket. He was the Zanzibar servant who had brought his master's body all the way from an African swamp, asking only to attend it across the ocean. In talents, the two men were a million miles apart. Livingstone, rich in technical skills, in social graces, in his wide vision of a world made well by those who care. The black had none of those gifts. His mind was handicapped. His color was a curse. His only gift was to be faithful. What our parable says is that if each man used what life gave, then in a Christian judgment, both get the same approval. In no other way could they ever touch equality. There is a cathedral in St. Louis, which I used to visit on trips from Washington University downtown to the public library. I had seen Gothic churches, but very little Byzantine architecture, except in books. So I enjoyed the chance to see the difference. And I stopped often at that cathedral. I was told one day that the mosaic on the walls, each little enameled bit about the size of your fingernail, thousands and thousands of them, were all set by hand by craftsmen imported from Italy because no one else knew exactly how to do it. It cost more than $5 million just for that part of the cathedral. When a guide turned the lights on for me one dark winter afternoon, those thousands of pieces of brightly colored mosaic at different angles blazed with color so rich, I lack the language to describe it. But I remember thinking that some less gifted people had to dig the foundation and do the concrete work, and how if they failed to get their work done well, the walls of mosaic would crack wide open. If all our gifts are crucial, then the distinctions we often make between great talent and small talent can be dangerous. We've had problems with the word talent, a word, by the way, which came into our language from this parable. We ask, is she talented? And we mean, does she paint? Does she play the piano? But some people who cannot do anything like that have a marvelous talent for being cheerful. When you're around them, you feel better. When they're gone, they leave you thinking that life has a nicer face than you had supposed. They would blush at being asked to sing or read a poem aloud in public, but they know ways of making life itself melodious. I have no special talents, the man said to me, and yet he ran his office with such gentle firmness, such serenity of spirit, such fairness to everybody, that the atmosphere in that room helped people to be happy and to work well. I have no special gift, the woman said, although she kept a home full of joy and peace and harmony with none of the tension and selfishness that spell unhappiness for a family. So please never say again, I have no talent, no gift, because the right response to that is the one I heard first a long time ago on a London music hall stage. Piffle, poppycock, and balderdash. You have your gift, and at certain moments it will be unique and crucial. A gift for being in the right place at the right time, for saying the gentle word, for offering the silent touch of compassion, and in life's strange and swift passage, it will be a talent no one else can use quite so well at times as you can. Stir up the gift that is in you, the Apostle Paul wrote to a young man. Don't deprive God of his treasure. That's the theme of this parable. Robert Louis Stevenson remembered it. One day in Samoa, among natives who had grown to love that sick but always hopeful man whom they called Tusitala, the teller of tales, out of their love for him, they built a road right up to the very door of his house. And on the day it was finished, Stevenson said to the Samoan chiefs in the language of our parable that the true hero was not a man of war, which they had thought for so long, but the man who makes good roads, a profitable servant using the talent that has been given to him in trust. It sounds a little immodest to hear Jesus say, "The words that I speak shall never pass away." But the amazing thing is that they don't. In stories like the one we've heard this morning, they live on from the first century to the 20th. They pass from Palestine around the world to a hilltop in Samoa. They are repeated in University Congregational Church on a day in the middle of January. And in this room, as always, there will be someone to whom they make a difference.